Okay, today is September the 9th, and I am back with 9999, actually. And I am back with Maureen Sharon in her office at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx for the third of her Pew interviews. So we talked a little bit towards the end yesterday about this fellow that you had in your lab. And what I was wondering was, if you could just tell me a little bit about your lab, the composition of it, who's there, who does what.
I have a mix of grad students and postdocs. It's about a 50-50 mix. I usually don't have a technician, although right now one of the visiting scientists has converted herself or asked to be converted to be a technician in the lab, and it's because of pension benefits and things like that. Mm-hmm. So now I have a technician, something that I haven't had since the first few years that I was here. Everybody's job is just to do their best. They're not really specific. They have individual projects that they work on, but most of the projects are integrated with others in the lab, so most people have to be good team players.
Mm-hmm. How many are there altogether?
Right now I have 6 or 7 and mm-hmm. a few floaters. In the past few years I've been it expands and contracts depending upon mm-hmm. the time of year. On average, I probably have about 8, sometimes 9, but it's gone up to about 14 in the summertime mm-hmm. with volunteers and visiting scientists from other countries. I like keeping it in the ballpark of 7 to 10. That's mm-hmm. pretty manageable. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, you really need to have several senior people that are among the group that are motivated to take leadership roles and help you to mentor the others. So I encourage people in the lab to do that and to do it as soon as possible. From a practical perspective, that doesn't really happen until after several years. So what I find is then senior graduate students become very good at training new students and fellows in the lab. Mm-hmm. Postdocs, it varies, and I can understand why, because they're on a much shorter timeline, and it takes time to train people. So some of them are more willing and are better at it than others, and others you see are not. They're more reluctant to do it. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. You mentioned yesterday that a fair number of your lab people are from other countries. We were talking about funding and whatnot. How does that break down?
In the past, I've had several French scientists, postdocs, a Dutch MD-PhD student, Taiwanese, but originally from Taiwan, but mm-hmm. then American permanent resident, who was a PhD student. I've had several people from mainland China. I think the majority of foreign students and fellows that I've had have been from mainland China, and that's reflective of what is in Albert Einstein and I think many other programs. The majority of foreign students and fellows come from mainland China. Mm-hmm. I get visiting scientists. I've had a visiting MD-PhD student from Sweden. I've had 2 from Israel. I get a mix.
Well, there's a lot. Actually, there was something in Science a couple months ago about this influx of foreign scientists, and is this good for or bad for the scientific community in the United States? What do you think?
I don't think it's good or bad. If scientists are scientists, if their goal is to go back to their country, well, then they've gotten the benefit of training in one of the best countries in the world to learn these technologies. Mm-hmm. If they're going to stay and they're good, we can at least objectively critique their experience, their publications, and if they can compete on the American market for jobs and will contribute to science, then that's good. So I don't view it as an American problem or benefit. It just is. Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of other countries have viewed it important for their scientists or students to leave the country after they get their degree and go to the U.S., mm-hmm. do their postdoc, and hopefully come back. So foreign perception has been positive. I don't think that if they leave that it's a loss, because the work that they'll do will be beneficial to everyone. American scientists aren't doing science just for the benefit of Americans. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a problem with that.
Okay. Before I go there, how much do you mentor in the lab? You know, we talked about how hands-on Harvey was or wasn't. How about you in your lab?
I'm a little bit less so now. As time goes on, I'm probably less so in the formal training sense, for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm here all the time that I'm not traveling, mm-hmm. and when I'm here, I'm always available to the students and fellows. So the kind of mentoring that I do now is more advice, help to critique their experimental data, to make suggestions about controls that should have been run or should be run for future experiments. My role is not the same kind of mentor that I was at the very beginning. At the very beginning, I was the one who was training them technically. And as I mentioned earlier in the interview, it just becomes impossible after a while to do the thing that you were the best trained to do, and for many of us was what we loved the most, which was the actual bench work. But that requires a time commitment that is fairly constant. A lot of experiments don't have easy stop points or can tolerate that you can only put an hour or two at the bench this day or that day. And even if it did, sometimes it's difficult if you have that hour or two to turn off the mode that you were in and then efficiently make that hour at the bench work and do that routinely. So early on, I taught people in the lab with my hands as well as with my mouth and my thoughts. But now it's, I would say, 90%. Some things I do show people, and other times I'll just say, well, when I was at your stage of development, I did it this way. I know that there are more modern ways of doing it. However, it worked this way then. I'm sure it can still do it now. So I can tell you what the pitfalls are if we take this approach. It'll probably take a little bit longer to do this way, but that never seemed to have affected me when I was at your stage. So Certain things I can't troubleshoot because I don't have the practical experience. I have some textbook knowledge of it, but I can't troubleshoot those things. So in that sense, other students in the lab or in other labs and fellows, etc., are people that they'll go to for that kind of advice. So in some respects, my mentoring skills are tuned by keeping an eye out for what labs are working on what kinds of projects, who in those labs have those techniques, or to call to that lab and say, hey, who in your lab is doing this now, and can the person from my lab come to yours and watch them, or at least get good protocols? So a lot of times I can help them that way, and my students and postdocs have actually come back and told me how valuable they felt that was, and often I think all I am is like a directory, and I'm just pointing people in different directions, but the truth of the matter is you can spend a lot of time spinning your wheels and going in the wrong direction, so I've come to appreciate that I can provide them with some valuable information that even to me, if it seems trivial or not so scientific, that it is important for them and their progress. One of my students a couple of weeks ago came in and told me she was having a problem with one of the experiments that she was doing. It was a technical issue. And using a procedure that I don't have hands-on experience with. So, of course, I give her the phone number of the former student and another former student that had done it routinely and said, well, call them up. They should be able to troubleshoot this. But have you considered comparing it to, it was an experiment in animals, and she was working with male animals, and all our previous work had been on females. And I said, well, what if there's a sexual dimorphism? Why don't you do a few females, see if you can reproduce what we had done before with the females, and then you'll see. Maybe this is a male-specific phenomena, and there isn't something wrong. And she turned the next day and said to me, you know, I'd been sitting and thinking and thinking, and I couldn't figure out. I was going deeper and deeper and more technical, and something that was an obvious practical thing I didn't even think of. And to me, I didn't see the value in what I told her. I figured it was just an obvious, common sense kind of a thing. And she pointed that out to me a day later, that she felt that was really important. And sometimes they think that they're asking me something small, or I, you know, unconsciously think I'm telling them something trivial, and they walk away and they feel that was a big help. So how you mentor and what you're doing when you're mentoring comes in different guises.
What about formal teaching? Do you have to teach classes?
Yes.
What is your load like?
It varies. Some years it's been as small as 3 or 4 lectures in graduate biochemistry. And the course
in a whole year.
Within the whole year. In general, the teaching loads in medical schools are smaller than the teaching loads at institutions where you have a large undergraduate population. I had a lot of teaching experience as a graduate student. I felt it was very valuable then. No teaching experience as a postdoc, except if I had a summer student that worked with me. And then as an independent investigator, I really felt that I loved doing research so much that I didn't want to spend a lot of time doing formal didactic lecturing. I believe that my talents are best spent teaching other people how to do good research, research tools, how to critique their themselves and others in a constructive way. And I also feel that my teaching is better done, maybe better serving people around me, and that I'm better at it if I'm teaching something that I really love. So a lot of the lecturing that I've done has been in my area of expertise. So the few lectures that I give on something that I really like. But I view that the lectures that I get invited to give, the seminars that I get invited to give, which are open to the entire communities of the institutions that I go to, I view that as a form of teaching. Mm-hmm. Because I'm talking about very basic research that has medical implications. So the audience can appreciate it at different levels. Mm-hmm. So I get a very broad audience. Sometimes I have many clinicians and clinical mm-hmm. fellows, and other times I have undergraduates and graduate mm-hmm. students, and get a very broad audience. And I've also been invited to teach a course in Israel. It was an elective course, special topics in glucose transporters and diabetes, and it ran for a little over a week in Be'er Sheva, Israel, at the medical school there, and I was invited to teach the entire course, and that gave me an opportunity to really pull together all the stuff that I had done. They didn't ask me to go into many areas that I hadn't done research on myself. Mm-hmm. There were some group discussions with other people that we were critiquing many papers in the field, some of which were my own as well as others. So we talked about issues, but they wanted me to highlight what I had done and how it fit into diabetes. And they felt that having the person that had done that work teach the medical students, the MD, PhD students, mm-hmm. and the graduate students that took it as an elective course, that would be beneficial to them. And that kind of teaching I really liked. I have also had years where the teaching load was my several graduate lectures in the beginning biochemistry class. And that was followed about a week later by several weeks of lectures to first-year medical students who were taking medical biochemistry. And the bottom line is very few of a class of 200 first-year medical students are truly interested in in biochemistry mm-hmm. and the biochemistry of carbohydrate metabolism. Mm-hmm. And what I found that kind of lecturing to be was absolutely horrifying. It was miserable. You're in a lecture hall, you have to present a handout that has every figure that you're going to show them. It's almost like you're dealing with babies, because if you don't give them a figure and you show it, you hear all the pages in the book turning feverishly. They can't go with the flow of the lecture. That wasn't in the book. What are you doing? And so you feel very restricted when you're teaching those kinds of classes. Often, students feel that you're there, you're being paid by them, they're paying a large tuition, you're being paid by them to teach them this, and they think that this is what you do every day of your life, and they don't realize that sometimes you've been asked to teach something that you don't know yourself, and you've just learned, and in fact, they're not paying my salary. My grants are paying my salary. So in a way, this is good citizenship on my part and volunteer work on my part, and I'm doing the best I can. Mm-hmm. But they ask questions with a tone. Mm-hmm. Some will frankly say, they out loud, if they don't like something. And that just makes it uncomfortable. You go in at the beginning. Most of the people that do these lectures have had these kinds of experiences. Mm-hmm. Some of the, you're not going to hear that from people that are teaching subjects that are very, very medical. Mm-hmm. Those students want to hear about medicine. They want to see things. They want to cut things. They want to get their hands on things that doctors do. And listening to biochemical pathways is boring. So what they want to know is, what do I need for the exam? Mm-hmm. And what am I going to need for the boards? I've never taken the boards. I don't know what you need for the boards. I'm just telling you what I think is important in this subject. Mm-hmm. Hopefully the people who write the exam for the boards feel the same. And it was such a period. One of the guys who had been lecturing in that course said to me, every year when I have to do it, my whole metabolism goes crazy. My wife can't take me anymore. I gain 20 pounds. Yeah. I'm a disaster on wheels. And I just remember going in, and my feeling was, all I hope to do is get through this and be almost invisible to the students, because by the end of the course, they have to evaluate each instructor. Mm-hmm. And I knew, I had never done this kind of teaching before. Many of the lectures I had to teach, I had never taken a course in myself. So the thought of getting the best evaluations was not anywhere in my mind. And the reward for being the best is doing it again and again, yeah, and again, yeah, and again. Yeah. So you really have to love it. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching something that I didn't love. Mm-hmm. I was doing it because it was assigned to me.
Plus, it's a lot of work if you don't know the subject.
It was a huge amount of work. Mm-hmm. And so stress at many levels. So my goal was to be the one who didn't do the work, I didn't want to do the worst job, because I would be outstanding for a bad reason. Yeah. So I hoped to be almost invisible, that when they got to the end of the course, I didn't stand out. I knew I wasn't going to stand out for being the best. So the only way that I could have stood out would have been for being an absolute disaster. Yeah. And the first year, I considered it a victory, because I didn't drop dead during the lectures. They didn't blurt out something that was so horrifying. There was one who blurted something out that was not... It was clear he was disgusted because I didn't know the answer to a question. And really, he had asked me something that was going to come later in the lecture. And because it was something I didn't know, I had my lecture material prepared in a way that when I shot the slide up on that, the answers or all the mm-hmm. cues that I would need mm-hmm. to remember what I taught myself would be there. Mm-hmm. And he asked me a question about 10 minutes before it would have come up in the lecture. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, we'll cover that in a few minutes. And he said, I want to know the answer now. And then I said, well, off the top of my head, I don't know. I was too honest. So can we advance the slides? And then I was a little bit frazzled, and the slide was a complicated one, and it was a pretty far distance. So I had to stand there and study the slide at the moment. And I really should have just said that you have bad manners.
Yeah.
And we're going to follow the course that I wanted mm-hmm. to take, and just hold your horses. We'll be there in a few minutes, mm-hmm. or we'll figure it out after lecture. But I was not savvy in that mm-hmm. way. So I just felt I had to get the answer. And So what I used to do was tell the guy who ran the slide projector, because you're in a giant auditorium, and the lecturer is down at the bottom, and there's a podium and that's huge podium with a light on it, and the podium is about level with the top of my head, and I felt uncomfortable being behind there, and there were several kinds of lighting you could have in the room. There were fluorescent lights that were over the center blackboards. So I would go in really early, and I would write all over the blackboards because I needed these were my security blankets. These were my notes. I'm not the kind of person, I can't read lecture notes to two people, much less 200. Mm-hmm. I'm not able to do that. So I needed to have, you know, an outline that was somewhere. So it had to be a combination of what I put on the board and what was in the slides, and I had to be able to get through it with that and nothing else. Mm-hmm. And the notes were there that if I completely went blank, hopefully then I could read something to give an answer. But I'm not the kind of person who can stand and read. Some people can do it, but many people don't appreciate it when you do that either. So I used to tell the guy who ran the slide projector, and he'd been doing it for like 30 years, Angelo, was a wonderful person. Angelo, do not for any reason turn on the house lights. I don't want to see their faces. I don't want to know that they're there.
Uh-huh.
It's much more calming for me if you just keep, you know, the bare minimum lights that are necessary for them to see their notebook so that they can write their notes. But I don't want high lighting. You know, I'm going to use slide after slide after slide after slide, and only if I go to the board and I'm not going to the slides for quite a while should you turn on the ceiling lights. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the board lights are adequate for what I need, and I feel much better. And I said, because I don't want to stand behind the podium, because it'll look like I'm hiding from them. And every so often, I would go behind the podium, and I just felt like, I wish there was a trap door here that I could just, because even, you know, I had a mobile mic. You know, they wire you with everything. I had power packs for everything, laser dots, and to change the slides for my, you know, volume on my mic. You were just wired all over the place. So there were some times where I would be walking around going, you know, from here to there or using this part of the board, and then I would end up behind the podium. And for 1 second, the thought would cross my mind, if there were a button here that I could push and have the bottom drop out, because they still hear me because of the microphone, but they couldn't see me for beans.
Yeah.
So I just felt, well, if I just dropped out, I can just sit down casually, give the rest of the lecture. And, you know, so many of them would put their tape recorders up, like, in front of you. And I often felt, well, maybe if they just left and me and the tape recorder sat together, I would just turn the tape over when necessary, and we would all feel much better.
Now, when you give a lecture, you know, a guest lecture somewhere, not to students, but, you know, you're invited someplace to give a lecture, are you as nervous? Or?
Oh, no.
No, it's only the students that do this to you?
The medical students. I mean, all I heard for several years were horror stories about the first-year medical students and how they can just tear you apart in their evaluations, and they're really cruel. Or some of them will sit there with the New York Times open wide, and they're not paying any attention to you, and then they throw the paper down on the floor, and they'll get up and walk out in a state of disgust. That's their
way. In the middle of the lecture?
In the middle of the lecture. That's their way of showing that they don't like you as a lecturer. And so you hear these horror stories, which I'm sure are not generally true, mm-hmm. but have happened. And then you're on top of that, you're teaching something that, at least in my case, I was not comfortable with.
Right. Sure.
So it wasn't a pleasant experience. What I can say had come out of it was the first year, the victory was that my evaluations were reasonable. They weren't great, they weren't bad, and in the written part, the worst, there was only one that was truly bad, and that comment was, I found Sharon to be completely useless. And that was it. Where other people, they would rage with plenty of adjectives that oh, were right. unappealing. So I considered this a victory.
It's a victory,
that
yeah.
that out of 200 people that had the opportunity to fill out mm-hmm. this form, only one of them that did fill it out, so 200 don't turn it in, but
yeah.
only one had said that I was useless. The other criticism that had come through was that I spent too much time on diabetes and glucose transport. And that was because those are the things that I like
That's
and
what
I
you
can
like.
Teach
yeah.
so much. And I kept trying to impart upon them that was something that I could make them feel as a clinician, irrespective of what specialty or not you go in. Many of your patients are going to be diabetic, and that number is getting worse, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you're going to have to know what the signs are and pick it up. If you're an internist, you're the first line of detection. If you're an endocrinologist, you'll be a main line of treatment. But if you're a cardiologist, a nephrologist, if you're an orthopedist, a rheumatologist, you are going to have a significant diabetic patient population. So you better understand the importance of regulated glucose homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
And so those lectures I knew a lot about, so I could get really excited about.
Sure.
And there I said to myself, this one thought I did too much on this. Wait until he or she sees how many patients
sure.
they have that are diabetics and how tough it is to control and how helpless they're going to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they'll understand why I tried in a course where they may not care to hear about how PepsiK is regulated or how important phosphofructokinase is in glycolysis. They should be able to understand that insulin-stimulated glucose transport and, you know, glucagon yeah. action are extremely important mm-hmm. to a physician, any physician. So the first year I had, that was my victory, to come out sort of unscathed.
Mm-hmm.
The second year, I was less apprehensive. Not that I knew so much more. It's just was the second time that I was having to say things that I was uncomfortable with, but my discomfort was less so because, one, the students hadn't shredded me the year before, so why to assume that they will do it this year?
Mm-hmm.
But also because I felt if I could get through it once, I can get through it twice. The second year, what I found was that several of the women in the class came up to me after lecture and told me how much they admired me for my strength and my courage and that they saw me as a positive role model. In the meantime, I wanted to say, do you know what my intestines are like? My God, I'm colitis. I'm falling apart at the seams. I'm a nervous wreck when I teach these lectures. I go home and I pray that you guys don't do anything bad to me. And what she said was that for weeks and weeks, they had been in medical school and hadn't really seen women teaching them. Mm-hmm. So they were wondering where we were, and they were getting mostly basic science courses. I guess they get some, a little bit of clinical introduction at that right. point, but they hadn't really seen female presence. And if you look around the class, at least, or about half of the class are women.
Yeah.
So that, to me, kind of hit home. And in a way, I felt good, and in a way, I felt bad. I felt good because, okay, they must be looking for this, and some of them found it and went out of their way to tell me mm-hmm. that they found it. And then I thought, I could be a much better role model at other things. If they think this is me as a role model, no, I don't think of this part of me as a role model. It's not what I do best. I can be a much better role model at other things. But I decided that whatever burden or benefits mm-hmm. went with that, I would take it. And that year, there were several lectures that I gave, and at the end, the students clapped. And what?
All right.
And I didn't really know what to do with that. Like, do I curtsy? Do I clap back? And what some people said to me is, it's so hard to get the first year med students in a basic science course
right.
to do that. Mm-hmm. That meant they really enjoyed your lecture. They really appreciated it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I noticed a big difference in the evaluations at the end of that year, but that wasn't really my objective. My objective was to get through it and not have a heart attack in the process.
Right.
And so that was, I guess, the bulk of my teaching would be, or the worst part of my teaching load would be, when I had to teach the graduate students and the medical students, because my misfortune, and it was accidental, was that the timing of my lectures in the graduate course and the timing of when my lectures would be in the medical course were that I had to deliver them with less than a week of separation between the two.
Oh, wow.
So I would be with the pressure of grading essays, 60 essays, from the graduate student mm-hmm. course, 60, and then if I asked multiple, 60 exams and multiple essays, it took a lot of time to mm-hmm. read through all of those. And then every week for the medical students, having to make up a quiz, and they would be multiple choice questions. So, as I've admitted, I can't answer a multiple choice question. I'm even worse at making up multiple
yeah.
choice questions.
Yeah.
So I would write them, and I felt like I was banging my head against the wall because there would be a committee in the department for this course, mm-hmm. and the elders who had been teaching the course for 20 years, they would take my questions and shred them to bits, and I felt, I'm learning nothing. I have no time. I have to write the lectures. I have to learn the lectures. I have to get the slides ready. I'm grading the graduate exams. I'm not going to learn how to write medical biochemistry multiple choice questions for their quizzes, and then you have to quickly write your section for their exam. So that would always come in too concentrated a period. Mm-hmm. So even though my total number of lectures between the two and clinical conferences that I ran would be in the ballpark of 14 or 15 appearances.
Wow.
How many hours and hours and hours did each appearance require, you know, in preparation and then post mm-hmm. analysis for all post time for grading things, but it all came within less than a month.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it crummy.
Yeah.
You know, if it yeah. were spread out over the year. So I was eager to not have to teach that again. And it also came right around grant deadline, an NIH grant deadline, which was right in sync with when my grant had to go in. So it just made for way too much. So I don't think that any one of those alone would have been enough to make me feel so terrible. But when you put it all together, it was, it just painted, you know, such a horrible picture. And so that was a little bit unfortunate. I can say that when medical students ask a question other than what do I need to know for the exam, they ask excellent questions. And that I appreciated. A really good question I like. One that makes me think. Not the simple, what is the allosteric regulator of this enzyme, but something that had a disease application made me see that they had gone beyond the basic science. I really liked that. And I saw that regularly in my medical school lectures.
Now, are you still teaching those?
No. They've revamped the whole beginning curriculum. And now it's a very integrative program where the basic sciences are melded together.
That's the trend.
Some of the Ivy League schools had gone that way first, and others then followed, and a lot of small group discussions. So I had begged out of the teaching. I had a good reason to beg out. I had a rupture in one of my retinas, and and I felt that teaching the medical school course was so, I was so dependent on being able to quickly read my slides. And when that happened, it took, it could have taken a year, 6 months. They didn't know how long it was going to take to resolve on itself, and I didn't want to have a surgery at that point in my life. So I told my chairman about a month after it happened that I had no idea when it was going to resolve, and that I felt really uncomfortable with having to do those lectures. I said, I can do the graduate student lectures because that I don't need to see things for. I was able to give my own seminar talks because as long as I had an idea of what slide I had up there, I knew what the data was that was on the slide. But I couldn't do the medical lectures. So some, they had recruited some new faculty to the department, and some were senior, more senior to myself, and had been teaching them these kinds of lectures at other medical schools. So someone else picked that up, and then the course was completely put into perspective with a new curriculum, and I have no idea now who's doing those lectures. But because I was on sabbatical last year, they wouldn't have asked me to do it, and this year no one has come and knocked on my door. So I view that in a positive way.
Okay, let me change the tape, turn it over.